Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane. The U.S. is still hoping to forestall a Palestinian bid to bring the question of statehood up for a vote at the U.N. Palestinian unilateral move comes amid dim prospects for restarting Mideast negotiations and major political shifts in the Arab world. Joining me to discuss the issue and implications, Ziad Asali is president and founder of the American Task Force on Palestine, Peter David, Washington, D.C. Bureau Chief for The Economist, and from a studio at WCPN in Cleveland, David Makovsky, Senior Fellow and Director of the Project on the Middle East Peace Process at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Welcome to you all. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hi. You can all join our conversation. Please do at 1-800-433-8850. As always is our number. And, of course, our email address is drshow@wamu.org, but you can also reach us on Twitter and Facebook. And please be part of this conversation. Let's start, Peter David, with the latest news. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton yesterday said there was extremely intensive, her phrase, extremely intensive diplomatic negotiations and overtures going on at the United Nations right now. President Obama will be there later today. What's the latest we know about progress on the diplomatic front?
Well, just to put this in some context, the Americans have been trying madly hard over recent weeks to fend off this bid for statehood that the Palestinians are taking to the United Nations. I suspect we will see negotiations go right up to the line, which means at least to Friday. But the likeliest outcome is going to be some form of American veto if the Palestinians succeed in getting a majority on the Security Council for a resolution that declares that they are a member of the United Nations, a proper state. Then I don't see how the President of the United States, having put himself in the position he has, can avoid casting a veto.
Now, you say Friday. That's the day when Mahmoud Abbas, the head of the Palestinian Authority, speaks to the United Nations. But a vote could be put off, right? I mean, there could be a... not all necessarily going to come to a head on Friday.
No. I mean, there have been reports in the Israeli press and elsewhere suggesting that there might be some sort of compromise language that the Palestinians will adopt, which will postpone things or dilute the request for statehood. But, you know, I think it's important to remember that the bottom line is this, that Mahmoud Abbas has invested this occasion with great symbolic importance as people are watching him. It would be very difficult for him to back down or water down the bid for statehood that he's embarked on.
Now, Ziad Asali, give us a sense from your point of view of why Abbas is moving now. Negotiations have been stalled for a long time. Right. What are the forces and the motivations behind this move now?
There are many forces at play, really. Fundamentally, is that the negotiation process has ended nowhere. Mm-hmm. And resistance, for whatever it's worth, that the Palestinians started out with 40, 50 years ago, ended up also nowhere. So these two pillars of pursuit of the state have yielded nothing. It has become clear that something else has to be tried. The issue of the United Nations, approach to the United Nations, started, you know, decades ago. But it's taken steam over the course of the past year because of the political forces within Palestine and in the region in general. I think you cannot isolate what's happening here from the Arab Spring. There's been, you know, an energized youth or public movement mm-hmm. that has, in fact, forced new pressures on leadership everywhere to be more responsive to people's demand. That is one main reason why I think. The other is that Palestinians have seen an opportunity, an actual opportunity, to pursue something that is still peaceful, is only considered unilateral by some powers in the world, but not by everybody, because what they're asking for is something essentially multilateral, to have the United Nations right. involved, and to show the world that they're not entirely impotent and that there is support for what they do. I think it's a form of pressure. on the United States primarily, which they believe has failed them. The president of the United States has failed them in the past, has yielded, so to speak, on the settlement expansion issue, and has not applied any pressure that has helped them with the Israeli government.
Now, David Makovsky, as Peter David said, the president has vowed to veto this measure. So even if the Palestinians would get a majority of the Security Council, the permanent members do have the veto power. The president has said he would use it. If he does that, what's the point then, if everybody understands this will not pass?
Well, I think, you know, you raised a good question, which is, you know, where's this all leading? And right now it looks kind of anticlimactic. I think there was kind of an implicit assumption between analysts following this that there would that Abbas was going to pivot in one of three directions after his speech on Friday. He would either go to move it to the UN General Assembly, where the United States does not have a veto, mm-hmm. try to get some status like the Vatican of a non-member state, or he would try to pivot even to the direct talks idea that the quartet, that's the U.S., European Union, Russia, and the UN want to put out there, or he might want to purposely draw a veto in order to kind of whip up enthusiasm in among the Palestinians to play off it in the Arab world. But what's I think looks like it's going to emerge is that none of these three pivots seem to be happening so soon, and that this could go on for many months because to go through Security Council, there's all sorts of procedural moves on committees and advisory opinions, and I think a lot of the momentum might dissipate. You also have the U.S. very frantically, along with other countries, working some of the members of the Security Council behind the scenes. It looks like Nigeria has said that it would abstain. Bosnia, which kind of owes the United States, is also considering. There's Gabon. And you need at least nine states, even if you say this was not going to reach ahead for several months, that you're going to need nine states to support it. What I think the U.S. is trying to do is to try to be in a situation where they don't even have to exercise the veto. And this is either lost in committee or there's not the requisite nine. Now, what does Abbas get out of it? It's unclear to me, frankly. I mean, I think he's just so boxed himself in on the Security Council that he's not able to pivot off of it right now. And I just think the listeners are going to be confused in America because I think this is going to be very anticlimactic.
Well, let me bring in Mr. Ossoli here. How would you answer the question of the veto threat is out there. Mm-hmm. The resolution is not going to pass. We know that. Mm-hmm. It may not get a majority. Even if it does, there is the veto. What does Mahmoud Abbas get out of this, and what does he hope to achieve?
Actually, there is a debit and credit mm-hmm. aspect of this. Mm-hmm. What he achieves is that he stands up for the Palestinians against the United States and the Israel and the occupation.
So it's a symbolic achievement.
It is symbolic in the highest order mm-hmm. that he did not buckle under. The fact that he fails is not going to shock anybody, even at home, although the expectations actually, I agree with David, expectations have been pushed so high that a lot of people over there think that they will have a state in a few days. So that is one thing that he would achieve. The counterpart to that is that it is precisely the expectations of the people that will be dashed, and the day after effects that may fall upon Palestinians, either from a Congress that is so committed to freezing all kinds of support, and to an Israel that is leaning further and further to the right with the view of punishing the Palestinians, and that is impacting on the day-to-day life of the Palestinians and affecting the achievements that they've already got over the last couple of years.
Now, Peter David, so every player in this has a lot at stake, including the President of the United States, who is in a situation where if he vetoes it, his longstanding campaign to encourage and improve relations with the Muslim world could be damaged. He's made this a major part of his foreign policy, spoken in Cairo, Istanbul, Jakarta about this. But at the same time, he's under political pressures where Republicans, this week, Rick Perry said he's following a policy of appeasement in the Middle East. So he's really pressures from both sides.
Yes, he's really in the most difficult position. As you say, he's worked terribly hard, not just on trying to move the peace process forward so that the Palestinians advance to statehood, but also to position the United States on what you might call the right side of the Arab Spring, the democratic
He was doing
awakening.
This long before the Arab Spring, though.
He was. Well, he certainly went, as you said, he toured the Muslim world. Mm-hmm. He made a particularly strong speech in Cairo in 2009, where he more or less promised that he would work very hard to mm-hmm. give the Palestinians their state. And indeed, he said about a year ago that by this time there ought to be a state. So, you know, he is a president who's gone out of his way in his first term to move the Palestinians to statehood. That's a pretty commendable effort by comparison with plenty of previous presidents, such as George W. Bush, who had other stuff on his plate, and he sort of pushed this to one side and never really picked it up properly. But the truth of the matter is he has precious little to show for all his efforts. And in Arab eyes, he's a president who picked a fight with the Israelis over settlements and then backed down, not once but twice, when Bibi Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister, pushed back. So he looks weak to the Arabs, and of course he's opened up this flank of attack from the Republican Party that he's not a proper friend of Israel.
USA Today quoted one Middle East expert this week as saying, Obama has angered all sides and earned acolytes on none.
Well, you might say that is the fate of any would-be peacemaker in this region.
We're going to be right back with your comments and your phone calls, so stay with us. More on the Middle East peace process and the UN debate. Welcome back. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in for Diane. Our subject this hour is the debate at the United Nations. President Obama will be there later today, and the Palestinian Authority has announced that on Friday it will seek resolution at the Security Council granting statehood to Palestine. And we've been discussing this with Ziad Asali, who is the president and founder of the American Task Force on Palestine, Peter David, bureau chief for The Economist in Washington, David Makovsky on the phone from Cleveland, who is at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Mr. Asali was starting to talk about some of the potential fallout from this. One of the dimensions here is American aid to the Palestinian Authority, which by one account is $600 million a year. Republicans on the Hill see an opening here politically to attack the Obama administration. What's your best read about what could happen in terms of American aid?
Well, it's a serious question. I should disclose that I testified last week in the House Foreign Affairs Committee with Elliot Abrams, who served in the Bush administration. We don't always agree on every single point, but we both agreed that it would be a terrible mistake to withhold the aid because it could lead to a collapse of the Palestinian Authority. And mm-hmm. in fact, the last 4 years, the security cooperation has been excellent between Israel and the United States, and I should say Israel and the Palestinian Authority. You've had 9.3% growth in the West Bank at a time of a worldwide recession. And there's been a lot of improvements on the ground. A lot of that is really to the credit of Palestinian Prime Minister Salam Fayyad and the Israelis, who have worked very nicely together below the radar at a time diplomatically where not much has been going on at all. On the ground, things have been better. And I think it would be a terrible mistake to lead to a collapse. I opened the New York Times this morning, and I saw an article of that Netanyahu pleaded with the Republican members of Congress who were visiting. I think some 81 members were there over the summer to not to cut off aid. It was in the case of $50 million that had been outstanding. And I think the Israeli view is don't make any hasty decisions. Of course, if the Palestinians resort to violence on the ground, then it's a different story. Then I could imagine an aid cutoff. But I don't see Abbas having that interest at all. That is not his record. So I think that if there's ways of displeasure to seek, it could be sought in different ways. But I think it would be a big mistake to lead to a collapse of the authority where things are actually on the ground better than ever in terms of the West Bank. Gaza is always a separate issue, but we could discuss that.
But at the same time, Peter David, that President Netanyahu has cooperated, as David has described, with the security forces. There's also the question, however, of expanding settlements. And under Netanyahu, settlements have tripled to 500,000-600,000 Israelis in what was in the occupied territories. And what's your best read about how is Netanyahu, as always, playing both sides of this?
First of all, let me make a general point in response to that question. I mean, one, and this is that there is a paradox here, which is that when things are quiet in the region and on the in the West Bank, when the Palestinian quality of life is improving, when the security forces are cooperating, this is great for both sides in one sense, but in another sense, it's very bad for the Palestinians because it removes all the incentive for the Israelis to move forward on the political front, and on the political front, Mr. Netanyahu is incredibly boxed in. Even if you give him the benefit of the doubt, which I don't, and believe that he would really like to move to a two-state solution, he is running a coalition government where there are plenty of people on the right of him who have no intention ever of agreeing to a two-state solution and who are promoting the settlement activity very fast. And the Palestinians rightly say that this is like two men arguing about sharing out a pizza while one of them gobbles it all up. So I think, I wouldn't give the Israelis too much of a free pass on this. They like the quiet. The quiet is good for the Palestinians, better than violence, but it means that the situation is locked.
Ziad Asali, you were nodding your head at that comment.
Yes. Clearly, there is this major argument about the erosion of the potential area that is available for the Palestinians to put their state on while the negotiations wind along without any progress, whatever progress is made on the ground. This is important, I think, to define the conflict. I believe this conflict is about two things: real estate and dignity. You have to make progress on both and lead to a resolution, which is a two-state solution, because there are no other solutions. There are many other options, none of which would be a conflict-ending solution. So if both parties do not find ways to work during the days of quiet and even prosperity and during the days of conflict to actually aim and plan to reach to that end, then the whole system will fall apart. I fear this is what's at stake now.
One other key variable here, David Makovsky, you mentioned that this whole process, UN, could be dragged on for a long time. But one of the potential options here, if the resolution of the Security Council fails, that it almost surely will, either by vote or by veto, there is this other option open to the Palestinians of going to the General Assembly and asking, as you pointed out earlier, to have their status changed to a non-member status, an upgrade from their current status of observer, equivalent, say, to the Vatican. Now, that if that status were to be changed by a majority vote, and it does appear to be a majority in favor of that in the General Assembly, then the Palestinian Authority would be able to belong to a number of UN organizations and would have the right to bring actions in the International Criminal Court. And I gather this is something that really worries Israel deeply.
You're right, Steve. I mean, this is their concern that because the Palestinian Authority Justice Minister went to The Hague in January 2009, you can go to the ICC, the Criminal Court's website, and they'll show you the PDF file of the application, that if they get an upgraded status, that they will be able to start hauling Israeli military officials to The Hague about the Intifada, the second Intifada of 2000-2004, the Gaza War of 2008-2009. Instead of trying to solve the differences around the table, it will just be litigated in the courtroom. As some people call this legal warfare or lawfare. So that's clearly one of their concerns. I do believe the U.S. and the Europeans would craft something behind the scenes that would try to take out some of these poison pills and to try to reshape a resolution that's more aspirational and maybe would jumpstart the talks that have long been stalled, which are really needed on the territorial issue. If I just may add, because Ziad knows very well, and I think Peter does too, I've spent a lot of time on maps and of how would you get to President Obama's peace ideas. And I do believe it's possible. Whatever one might say about the settlements, I wouldn't use the word gobbling. I would say nibbling, but it's 80% of the settlers live near the old border. And there would be what we call land swaps, which are land exchanges, that if Israel would keep that 5% of the West Bank, they would yield a different 5% that would be contiguous. And so I don't think people should give up on the two-state solution. And there's not been new settlements every day the way some people have made it out to be. Most of the settlers live in an area that the Palestinians concede will be Israel. But because there's no deal, there's a perception out there that's strong. I'm not saying there are not scattered settlements all over the place, but it's not evenly distributed.
But it is,
and therefore President Obama's ideas are important, that there is a way still to reach a two-state solution based on fairness and equal land swaps.
But as Peter David was saying, the role of the settlers is not just a question of real estate. It's also a question of political pressure, and they are an important force within the Israeli community and within the Israel government, aren't they, in terms of limiting the flexibility of Netanyahu?
Absolutely, but that makes the importance of reaching a territorial deal so much more important, because that would make the settlement issue moot. If you had a border, then those 80% of the people who live in that 5%, largely adjacent to the old pre-67 boundary, they would be part of Israel. Their interests are different than the remaining 20%, no matter how you gerrymander this. So I think it makes it more of an imperative to try to reach a territorial solution that would give dignity to both sides.
Let me read some emails from some of our listeners, and a lot of people want to get in on this conversation. This first one is from Peter in Winchester, New Hampshire. He writes, "It is important to realize, since this will probably become a campaign issue in the next American election, that American Jews are not of one mind on this issue. Many of us recognize that there is a good deal about this problem that can be laid to Israeli intransigence as well as Palestinian disorder. It proves once again the dangers involved when religion is married to politics." Peter David.
I think that's a good point about American Jews. I mean, the opinion in the community here is very divided. There is an organization, J Street, which is trying to challenge the dominant view of AIPAC, which has for a long time been the voice of American Friends of Israel.
Which is the American Israel Political Action Committee. Yes.
Exactly. However, I do think this talk about the Jewish vote, if we're going to talk about the election, mm-hmm. is sometimes a little bit overblown. I mean, in general, Jews are Democrats. Their votes tend to be cast for the reasons that other Americans have for casting their votes. They care about Israel, but I don't believe, except in a very few places, that the Jewish vote, as influenced by what's happening on the Palestinian front, is likely to be decisive. Perhaps what's more worrying to the Democratic Party is reports that some Jewish donors to the party, big donors to the party, are unhappy with the president's approach.
Although in that district in New York, which received a lot of attention, a heavily Democratic district with a large Jewish population, just in the last week or two was voted in a Republican member of Congress, and that got a lot of people's attention.
That's right, and you know, former Mayor Ed Koch was very much part of that. I mean, what I don't want to minimize is the fact that, you know, the president, I mean, President Obama, has a problem if he is perceived as being unfriendly to Israel, not only with Jews, but with evangelicals and others.
Ziad, you want to?
Yes, of course. This is a very important point for us. I think it is as wrong to talk about a Jewish position on this as it is to talk about the Palestinian or Arab position. People are divided into many points of views and orientations. It is particularly significant, I think, that 70% of the American Jewish population is for a two-state solution, and we make it a point to seek out relations with those in particular because they have a common stake in solving this problem. And I think it is important for people like us not to enter into intra-Jewish fights about this. And that's exactly what we do.
I'm Steve Roberts, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Another email here from Harriet in Arlington, Virginia. Question, if Palestine becomes a member of the United Nations, won't that mean that it and Israel will be held more accountable for the respective actions against one another, which I think would be a very good thing? She adds, I feel that opposing this will increase the hatred against the U.S. in the Middle East. We cannot afford for that to happen. David?
Well, I think we all want this tragedy to end. And the question is, which is the best way to accomplish that? And I think it is through negotiations. I think it probably should be on the basis of President Obama's speeches. And that's important. I'm not so sure the U.N., admitting it in the U.N. will lead to greater accountability. Because the UN has been, sadly to say, rather reflexive in its criticism of Israel, and it is not viewed as an arbiter at all. So it's more a political body, and it's a shame that in terms of its moral authority it is so eroded. But I think I share her sentiment that there's a need to end this tragedy, and I think we could give these talks direction, focus, structure, by focusing on these practical issues, borders and security, mutual recognition.
What about her second comment that we talked about this briefly, that if the United States can't diplomatically avoid the showdown and is forced to issue a veto, this will only further diminish American influence and reputation in the Middle East?
Well, we have to be careful in making grand predictions only because that was what people said in February when there was a Security Council vote on the settlements issue. And no, everyone was so worried and nothing happened because in the year 2011, for the Arabs, it seems much more the focus is inward about their own countries, about, all the turmoil in their respective countries. And if you look at all the placards of the Arab Spring, they weren't against Israel. They weren't against the United States. They were about personal empowerment and dignity, economic advancement. And I think that is much more the spirit of the times.
Let me turn to some of our other callers because a lot of people want to get in on this. We'll start with Daniel in Little Rock, Arkansas. Daniel, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you, Steve, so much. My question is, we already know what Israel is. We have 100% is Israel. We know what 100% of the territory is Palestine, and then we have that gray area that's in dispute. Why can't we go ahead and give statehood to what we already know and continue to discuss the issue of the disputed territories? And in doing so, we're at least going to globally enfranchise through the United Nations the Palestinian state. Why can't we just get that hammered out and continue to work on the disputed territories?
Ziad Asali.
Yes, I think the Palestinians have traditionally, and I think rightly, been opposed to any idea about a provisional government on a sub-segment of the land because they understand the balance of power too well and understand that once they get established in a certain place, their chances of expanding to what they think is a reasonable general agreement around based on 67 solution will not be achieved. That in this case would include something exceptionally significant, which is Jerusalem itself. And now Jerusalem is an issue that is way beyond the Palestinians and the Israelis. It's an international issue of symbolic significance to many people on earth, and it is important to have that part of the final agreement anyway. And you cannot just lead up to it and then living during which period you live with an undefined status quo, which has never worked in the favor of the Palestinians.
Quickly, your organization favors a two-state solution.
Yes,
so does the Palestinian Authority. They've agreed to that in Oslo and other places. But you also have Hamas, which rules Gaza, which has not signed on to that idea.
Yes, yes. Hamas is a separate problem. It actually, in many ways, it argues in actions for people to conclude that the any kind of a negotiation or an agreement in the meantime is not in its benefit, and it perpetuates the status quo, which means the occupation.
That's Ziad Asali. He is from the American Task Force on Palestine. Peter David from The Economist. David McCoskey from the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in for Diane. We'll be back with more of your phone calls. Stay with us.
National broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, dedicated to educating wonks to use knowledge to change the world. More at american.edu/wonk. By the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, at gatesfoundation.org. And by Vicky and Roger Sant and Island Press, which offers solutions to environmental problems in print, in person, and online at islandpress.org. This is NPR.
Author and playwright Carol Phillips was born in St. Kitts, grew up in England, and now lives in the U.S. His views on culture, race, and our universal yearning to belong. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane. She's attending a public radio conference and will be back on Monday. And our subject this hour is the debate at the United Nations over the intention of the Palestinian Authority on Friday to seek resolution at the Security Council to declare a Palestinian statehood. And the president, President Obama, is speaking as we are on the air at the UN General Assembly. And we have, I want to read the panel a quote from the president and get your reactions. He just said this a few minutes ago. He refers back to his earlier remarks at the General Assembly, and he says, "I believe then and I believe now that the Palestinian people deserve a state of their own. But what I also said is that genuine peace can only be realized between Israelis and Palestinians themselves. Peace will not come through statements and resolutions at the UN. If it were that easy, it would have been accomplished by now." What's your reaction to that, Peter?
Well, my reaction is that the president is probably wrong when he says that peace can only come in negotiations between Israelis and Palestinians themselves. You could argue that the history of the last 20 years, if not longer, shows that the Israelis and the Palestinians on their own cannot agree to peace. There have been plenty of talks over the years. The negotiations have burrowed down into all the details. You know, everything has been discussed over and again. And the two sides hold pretty irreconcilable positions about the demarcation of the borders, about the fate of the Palestinian refugees, and about the status of Jerusalem, and so on. It will take some powerful outside country or body, preferably the United States, in my view, to intervene in a muscular way into this conflict in order to resolve it. So I disagree with what the president just said.
And David Makovsky, hasn't the United States been trying to do exactly that for many years?
Well, look, I think there's one thing to say, you need to have active U.S. mediation. I would agree with Peter on that. But that's very different by saying by UN, by fiat, there should be some sort of an imposed solution of sorts. Look, the United States has had times where it's been more successful and less successful. But often, if you look, there has to be the will of the parties themselves. The Oslo Accord of 1993 was that the parties did this in Norway without the United States. They came for a handshake on the White House lawn with Bill Clinton, but it was the parties themselves. In 2008, Ehud Olmert agreed to the internationalization of parts of Jerusalem, agreed to this idea of a one-for-one land exchange, and still there was no deal. So there have been times it's worked with the U.S. There have been times it's worked without the U.S. But I think that for the most part, you know, there have been moments where it looked very tantalizingly close. I don't want to get into the recriminations.
Right, I know, because I want to bring in the Ziad Asali here. Your reactions to the president's remarks this morning.
My reaction is as follows. The negotiation between the Palestinians and Israelis are necessary but insufficient to resolve this issue. There is a scandalous imbalance of power between the Palestinians and the Israelis, but there is no way that this process can move forward without active negotiations between the Palestinians and the Israelis. So that's necessary. However, there are other parties that have an interest in the outcome and resolution of this issue. Above all, the United States has an interest, own interest to protect, and it is the indispensable partner to these two minor partners in order to move this process forward, not just to facilitate it, to facilitate the understanding, the ideas, the negotiation, and eventually to bring about the wherewithal to make whatever agreements applicable and amendable. The history of the last 20 years indeed has been, you know, on and off negotiations between the Palestinians, and it has not yielded much. So we need to keep that in mind. However, to dismiss, you know, the other players would mean, unfortunately, a possibility of continuation of the status quo, which is continuation of occupation, which means the absence of a Palestinian state, which means the absence of peace.
Let me go to some of our callers here who have been waiting patiently. Mary from Bristol, Indiana, is it?
Yes.
Okay. Welcome. You're on the Diane Rehm Show. What's on your mind this morning?
Well, I cannot understand why the president would take the position he does on why we have over the years taken the position we have on this issue, because we've through the Arab Spring, democratic concerns throughout other situations, but when it comes to Palestinians, we pretty much in the end let Israel do as they please, and we.
Okay, Mary, I'm afraid we were having trouble hearing you because of your phone line. I think we've got the point of your call, David Makovsky.
Look, I think if you look at U.S. aid to the Palestinians, it's per capita probably as high as also it is to Israel, which has also been very generous. The United States has devoted a huge amount of diplomatic effort on this issue. I can't imagine another conflict in the world that the U.S. has put in as much effort. So it's easy to beat up on America, but America has at least been trying. It's had some successes. I think there's a way. I thought President Obama deserved a lot of credit for a speech where he said, look, let's resume talks, but with the structure. And that, I think, would give these talks some direction. If I would fault the administration on one issue, I tend to believe that we played a huge card of tough love, so to speak, when it came to Israel in May, but we did not extract anything in response from the Europeans, who have been generally the patrons of the Palestinians, in giving a European corollary speech of tough love,
which
would have helped these talks a lot.
Okay, let me turn to Mark in Cleveland, Ohio. Welcome. You're on the Diane Rehm Show, Mark.
Hi, Steve.
Please go ahead.
My point is similar to Mary's. To me, it is unthinkable, that this country, which professes to believe in human liberty, would deny the Palestinian people their opportunity. It's not even a guarantee, their opportunity for statehood. My only question is a short rhetorical question. It may come across rather simplistic, but how do we believe that there will ever be peace in the Middle East if the needs of the Palestinian people are thwarted? So those are my thoughts, and I think the president is embarking down the wrong path, and apparently for his own political gain.
Okay, thank you, Mark. We appreciate your call. Peter?
Well, I hear the underlying sentiment, but I mean, the devil is in the details. Yes, of course, I think everyone can agree that the Palestinians deserve their own state just as much as the Israelis do. The question is the borders. The question is on what terms.
The president said that today. He repeat that in his remarks. Yeah.
Quite so. I think if the president could wave a wand, he would like to create a state of Palestine. It would serve him well, actually, in America's general standing throughout the Muslim world, indeed throughout the world. But, there are some Palestinians who make maximal demands, those in Hamas, for example. There are difficult and deep arguments to resolve, so I'm afraid it's just not as simple as giving the nod.
Yeah, I think the two-state solution is the policy of the United States, as it is of Israel and Palestine, indeed the whole world, which is the quartet. But what stands between us, between policy and implementation, is politics. So there's the politics of the United States, there's politics of the Palestinians, and there's politics of the Israelis. And what we need, in fact, is to establish bridges, or political bridges, between Palestinian and Israeli forces who really can work together and help each other and empower each other to create a political constituency in both places for a two-state solution and have the support of the United States behind that venture. I think this is one model that can get us out of this politics always trumping policy.
Let's turn to Zach in San Antonio, Texas. Welcome. You're on the Diane Rehm Show, Zach.
Hello. I want to say that for the longest time, the Arabs refused to recognize Israel. The push was for the longest time. And till Egypt and Jordan decided to sign the peace treaty with them. Why is it not now recognizing the Palestinians as a human rights issue? What I'm trying to say right here is your hosts right here, they're taking middle grounds to discuss the issue. Why don't they come out and say it like it is? Thank you very much.
A reaction?
I just say that the way that the peace was done with Egypt and Jordan was through negotiations. In the case of Sadat, he actually made a historic trip to Jerusalem in 1977. He got every inch of his land back. In Jordan, there was also a peace treaty based on talks with King Hussein and Israel. The president said it, I understand, this morning at the UN. There's no shortcuts here. And it's not about politics. It's about trying to, what Peter said, the devil is in the details. I do think Olmert's offer in 2008, that's what ultimately it's going to be. And it's a shame that that offer was not taken up, because it was all the basis of what the Palestinians wanted, essentially.
Now, I'm glad you brought up the subject of Egypt and also Turkey as well. These have been two of the more stalwart Muslim countries in terms of the relations. You mentioned the historic trip of Anwar Sadat, the enduring peace agreement with Egypt, but the Israeli embassy was attacked in Cairo, deteriorating relations with Turkey, which has been an important ally in the Muslim world. What part, David, is are those developments playing in what we're seeing in New York?
Well, I don't know if immediately in New York we're going to see it, but I think, Steve, you raised some important issues, which is, you know, at this time of, like, the lid has come off these Arab societies. We pray for these people that they will exercise their democratic rights. But until we get there, it is probably going to mean a boost for some of these Islamist parties, whether it's the Muslim Brotherhood, the Salafis, and others. And they will play off the paralysis on this issue. I don't know what it will be in New York, but I do think that the populism and the radicalism of some of these groups make it even more of an imperative that these parties sort out their differences. In the old days, Israel could have peace with leaders. Now it's got to have peace with peoples. That's much harder to do when, whether it's in Ankara, whether it's in Cairo, wherever it is, these more Islamist parties are playing off the paralysis of this issue. So I think it makes it vitally important that the talks are resumed and that they make progress. You know, each side has got their reason why there's no talks. Netanyahu will say, you've only met me for 2 weeks in 2.5 years. Give it a chance, and Abbas will say, no, because I don't believe you'd reach a deal. So they have to sit down, and there has to be a basis for these talks, because I think the regional context now is changing, and this is going to be a much more a dangerous Middle East in the short term, as we hopefully get to a better long term of democratic Middle East states. So I think it's an imperative to work something out on the ground.
I'm Steve Roberts.
At the table.
I'm Steve Roberts, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We have an email from Jim in Brick, New Jersey, who says, could the panel comment on whatever inside conversations are probably being had between Secretary Hillary Clinton and President Obama about the statehood question? Peter, Dave, do you have any insight into that?
I don't. I'm afraid I haven't been eavesdropping. but I guess, what is really at stake here is, American prestige and influence on the one hand and some domestic political calculations on the other.
And
I think America is trying to avoid a veto. And this is, again, a question of what the national interest of the United States in resolving this issue and avoiding getting exactly at the wrong side of history as the Arab Spring unfolds and the empowerment of the people is now a positive thing for America. Now, this brings us back to what David was saying. Israel has to understand that this is going to have to be a peace with the people in the region, not with leaders who would come and go. And clearly, it's easier for these leaders to go these days. So to coming to peace with the Palestinian people means agreeing in principle as a matter of policy and a matter of implementation to make peace about achieving and implementing a state of Palestine rather than talking about it as an objective.
Okay, we only have a few minutes left, and all of you have agreed that the major players, with the possible exception of Hamas, agree a two-state solution is the only enduring answer, and that there are forces within the United States, within Israel, within Palestine, who all support this. And yet, as you've all agreed, politics has stayed been in the way here. I want each of you to talk about the obstacles within different countries. And Peter, start with the United States. What are the obstacles within the United States toward moving forward here, the political obstacles?
Well, I think we've seen that the Republicans have grabbed this issue, and therefore I very much doubt that between now and the American election in November next year, we'll see any pressure from the United States applied to the Israelis. And I'm afraid that if Bibi Netanyahu remains prime minister of the coalition he heads, that means we will have deadlock for the coming year.
Ziad, tell me about the Palestinian picture and the politics of the Palestinian picture.
Yeah, there are the known differences between Hamas and Fatah or its group, which physically means really two functional governments. And there is a difference between the people who support the concept of resistance, standing up to the Israelis and the United States, and those who want to negotiate. Even those who negotiate, there is a split amongst those who want to make a negotiation with the basis of an understanding and close relations strategically with the United States and then with Israel, rather than those who say, we want to oppose the United States and have alliances within the region, whatever forces there are, with the global emerging support for the Palestinians.
I thought it was interesting that Abbas went out of his way in his speech to say, we're not talking about delegitimizing Israel, we're talking about delegitimizing the occupation.
Yes.
And this is not a point of view shared by Hamas.
No, of course not. Of course, this is fundamentally not a point of view shared by Hamas. And I think clearly he understands the limitations of the Palestinian power, that he cannot really go against Israel to delegitimize it and go against the United States also at the same time.
Final word, David, the politics of Israel.
There, you know, you have 70% of the Israeli public says they accept a two-state solution. But then the next question, the polls say, does the other side accept a two-state solution? And then the number's 30%. And I think you see a kind of a mirror imaging on the Palestinian public opinion. You used to have constituencies on the political spectrum of an active peace camp. Certainly in Israel, you would see huge peace rallies. But what's happened is, with all the violence and Israel getting out of Gaza and Lebanon and facing rockets, is that that peace camp has been decimated. What you need to do is reconfigure the government so Netanyahu and Tzipi Livni of the Kadima centrist party, that they sit together and really optimize the 70% and rebuild these constituencies for peace that have been there and have been dormant.
David Makovsky, Ziad Asli. And Peter David, thank you so much for being with us this morning. Thanks for our listeners and all of the emails and calls we've gotten. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane. She's at a public radio conference and we'll be back on Monday. Thanks very much for listening.